And welcome one and all. I'd like to welcome to our table Chris Brule. There he is. Chris is the president of the Business Council of Fairfield County. I felt that that was an important voice to have at this table, so I've asked him to join in our discussion today and going forward. We'll look forward to Chris's appointment on a commission at some point, hopefully in the near future. Thank you, Chris. I don't have on the agenda today the approval of the minutes from the last meeting, so I'm remiss in that, I believe. Thank you, Lindy. Do I hear a second? Judy is second of the motion.
John?
Yes?
I did make a note. I was at the last meeting.
Okay.
And wasn't listed there, so if we can just...
Yes, and as a matter of fact, I do see your name on here. The
okay.
April 9th meeting?
Yes.
Yes.
All right, so they've been amended?
Mine, so.
Excellent. Okay.
Very good.
Sounds good.
Any further comments on this on the minutes? Hearing none, all in favor? Thank you. We'll have two basic components to our meeting today. One will be a presentation by both our DECD Commissioner Catherine Smith and one by our Department of Labor economist Patrick Flaherty. And after that, we will have a discussion in regards to our RFP for hiring a consultant. That's something that we need to get to and review today and move forward. Our plan at this point is to have a public proposal out there on or around June 7th. So it's action that we need to get to today. Let's begin with a presentation by Patrick Flaherty. Patrick, thank you.
Thank you, John. Happy to be here, of course. And I know usually in this room the procedure is the person talks and then there's questions afterwards, but when I speak, I normally invite questions during. So however you want to handle it is up to you and I guess the members. Obviously, I'm here, happy to be here on behalf of our Commissioner, Sharon Palmer, our Director of Research, Andy Condon, and I'm sure either one of them would also be happy to answer questions if I get stuck on something.
What? Jeannie has reminded me that if you would like to ask a question or provide a comment, that you press the red button for recording purposes. Thank you.
Okay.
And I'll try to remember that.
And how much time would you like me to go?
4 hours.
let's try for 20 minutes.
20 minutes. Okay. 3:25 will be done. I promise. I teach undergraduates. When you say you're going to end on time, you end on time. So first of all, just to talk a little about the current situation. So this is employment change by month nationally. And obviously, big newsflash, we had the worst recession since World War II a few years ago. And since then, we've had some fairly significant job growth. The big blip up and down is the census workers coming in and out. And the past few months, we've had decent, although not spectacular, job growth. Friday, the first Friday of the month, is when the employment numbers come out, and Twitter is actually fun to watch during that time. And this is a tweet that went out. I did verify the numbers before I put it in the slide. And it's interesting that in the past 12 months, it is those that have a college degree that have seen a significant employment increase. Those that had some college have had 500,000 more people hired. But for those that haven't ever gone to college, in fact, employment prospects have deteriorated in the past year, even though this is a year of recovery. So that is something to bear in mind, and I'll be giving you some details about Connecticut later on. This is the most frustrating chart of the presentation. We have a very high unemployment rate by historic standards, and yet the number of openings that companies are reporting is high and rising. There are a number of discussions around this. Is it a skills gap? I think that employers have just become extraordinarily fussy. They may just not see the demand for their products and services, and so they're putting openings out. In case it's just the right person happens to come along, they'll hire them. This is a very, very frustrating statistic. Traditionally, you would think with a high unemployment rate, you'd have very low openings, because the idea is that employers can go into the pool of unemployed and hire somebody right away. This is a historical anomaly to have the number of openings so high with the unemployment rate so high. One possible explanation, although this explanation is weakening a little bit, is that the quit rate still remains quite low. So the person with just the right skills that the employer wants to hire may already have a job. This is one of the couple of hard math problems that we'll have for this afternoon. So this one is this. Every person who is currently working has more experience than the day they were hired. Now, this means that their employer was actually willing to hire somebody with less experience. And so one of the things that we do would like to see happen is some of those folks to move on in their careers and perhaps make room for somebody else. And so part of the issue with the high amount of openings may just be that folks are cautious, they're hunkered down, they don't want to move on in their careers. Why move on in a new job? You've got seniority where you are. And so that also may be part of it. So I do think that there's both a lack of courage on the part of some of our workers and a lack of flexibility on the part of some of our employers to hire the person who is there ready to go to work as opposed to that perfect employee. Yes, sir.
Just curious, any idea how much is a mismatch of skills and what they're looking for?
Well, the employers tell us it's all that, right? The employers are saying that they want to find just the right person. And in fact, we had a conference on Friday, and there was a panel of advanced manufacturers and a bunch of HR people, one of whom was talking about this opening that she'd had for 18 months trying to fill it. One of the educators in the audience asked, well, what was wrong with all the applications you had? And she said, well, she went through like a 3 or 4 people, all of which had like two or three of the four things she was looking for, but they didn't have this particular software experience, or there was this particular machine they hadn't used. And so there really was quite an interesting discussion, because there are educators saying, listen, we're sending you somebody with 85% of what you want, and you're not hiring them because that you need that 100%, which is a change from where I think industry used to be in terms of the investment in job training. Turning to Connecticut, so one of the things that we see in the press all the time is this idea that there has been no job growth in over 20 years, and this is both true and not true. So the true part is the red line, which is the latest employment numbers we have, and you can see that we are still at the same level of employment that we were back somewhere in the mid-80s. Where it's not true is that you can see we had the terrible recession of the late 80s and the early 90s, followed by some years of very significant and very robust job growth. So there have been years of job growth. We obviously had that recession that happened after 9/11, and then we came back from that. And then, of course, the most recent decline, while I mentioned it was the worst recession since World War II, actually was not so for Connecticut. Connecticut's experience in the late 80s and early 90s is actually worse. We seem to be somewhat repeating the pattern of the late 80s, early 90s, where we had some pretty good job growth. We've actually now slowed down a little bit over the past several months, but seem to be poised again for hopefully what will be very strong job growth over the next couple of years. I think this year is going to still be a weakish year, but we're looking for a more positive growth next year. So where we were in 1990 or where we are today, about the same overall level of employment, so that bar at the very top is kind of small. It basically, we have very little job growth since 1990. But, of course, the industry composition of our economy has changed dramatically. We have almost 125,000 drop in manufacturing jobs over that period, while large increases in education, healthcare, arts and entertainment, accommodation and food service. One of the things, of course, in the arts, entertainment, recreation sector that happened since 1990 is the development of the casinos in southeastern Connecticut. Uh, I am responsible, as part of the team, to do the projections for Connecticut. We start by looking at the projections that the federal government provides us. So every 2 years, the Bureau of Labor Statistics produces 10-year projections. The latest projections are the 2010 to 20. And this phenomenon of an aging population and increased demand for health care is certainly not unique to Connecticut. It's something that is being seen. Although, it's funny, when I talk to my colleagues in every state, they all think it's them. Well, our population is aging, and so we're seeing an increased demand for nurses and other healthcare practitioners, as if like it's only them. That it's actually kind of amusing. It's actually happening throughout the country. Construction, while showing fairly strong growth from 2010 to 20, at 2020 will still be below where construction employment was in 2000. So, yeah, even though we're projected significant growth over the next years, still not back to where we were back at the beginning of the century. And then there are over 700 occupations in the economy. I just happened to put the ones with the most growth on this chart, but there are many ways to slice and dice the occupational projections, which we're going to get to in a minute. And so don't panic if your favorite occupation doesn't happen to make the list. What I found interesting is that they just came out with the new SOC, stands for Standard Occupational Classification. So when you look at how the occupations are being reorganized, might get some clue as some of the changes that are happening in our economy. So we see a number of healthcare occupations that obviously have existed in the past but are now being classified in their own occupation. For example, nurse practitioners have been reported separately. Gives us a clue that there's some kind of structural change happening within that industry. Obviously, we see a number of IT professions on here, some really brand new occupations such as wind turbine service technicians and genetic counselors, things that really did not exist even a few years ago. So as I mentioned, I do the projections with the rest of the team for Connecticut. These are our industry projections over the next 10 years. I will just note that very slight decrease we're showing in manufacturing is actually a real inflection point from the massive losses that we've seen over the past couple of decades. And even within a slightly declining manufacturing industry, there's still going to be a lot of opportunities. I will highlight this idea. This is the overall employment. We're about half of our employees today are over the age of 45, but about two-thirds of our manufacturing employees are over the age of 45. So in the context of flattish employment growth, there's going to be a wave of retirements. And so all of the work that we're doing in our manufacturing centers, in the community colleges and other things to try to get a workforce ready for manufacturing, those opportunities are going to be there even under the in the context of a projection that shows a slight decrease. One of the problems I think that we've been facing in getting people interested in going into manufacturing is there really is a generation of people, probably around the generation that I'm in, where we saw our people of our parents' generation losing their manufacturing jobs and deciding not to go into that. And now that we have kids are saying, well, maybe you don't want to look into that. And so there's sort of a real I don't want to call it PR, but an education thing that has to happen in terms of the fact that there really are going to be opportunities in manufacturing. We report our occupations in a variety of ways. One way is to look at overall openings, which includes all of the turnover. So jobs like cashiers and waitresses and waiters are always going to rise to the top just because those are the kind of occupations people have for just a few years often and then move on in their careers. If we look at the ones that are going to grow more, we're saying there will be more people in this occupation 10 years from today than there are now, you can see a number of the healthcare occupations really do rise to the top. And then we can look at the occupations based on the education level required to get into the occupation. And so these are the top occupations that require a bachelor's degree or more based on our projections. And there's been a lot of discussion around the middle skill occupations, and there'll be a number of openings in some of the fields. We talk about middle skills being those occupations that require more than a high school diploma, but less than a bachelor's degree. And we can look at it in terms of total openings, in terms of growth openings, and again, when we just look specifically at growth, we see a number of the healthcare occupations really do rise to the top. And there's also been a lot of discussion around STEM. STEM is, of course, science, technology, engineering, and math. And one of the things about these occupations, some of them are fairly new, that they sort of slice them and dice them into very small bins. So while you don't necessarily see the STEM occupations in the top of the list for overall, when you look at the different kinds of computer support folks and you sort of add them all together, you can see that it's actually a fairly significant sector that's going to see increased employment over the next 10 years. So, you know, we have a lot of discussion around whether or not, and I know that there's been some discussion in this very building about whether these projections are even worth anything, and I'm going to argue that they are. On the one hand, there are some things that we will never know. So as a forecaster, I get a lot of comfort over the fact that that he actually won his Nobel Prize more than 10 years after making the statement that the internet's impact on the economy was going to be so small. But on the other hand, if we just got rid of the projections and just sort of let things take their course, and I apologize, this is the one economic theory that we're going to see. This is the cobweb model, which I teach to my undergraduates, which is that if there's a sudden increase in demand for a particular occupation, it takes a while to actually train up. So the wages are going to go up a lot. And then folks deciding whether or not to go to school or not see those high wages, and they all rush into that occupation. And then you end up with oversupply, and then the wages fall, and, you know, it goes around and around. That's why they call it the cobweb. If there's no plan, if there's no attempt at all at trying to look at projections and do some planning, you're just going to end up in this cobweb. So on the one hand, we can say that there are things that we cannot see, and therefore we shouldn't bother to try. But I would argue that our projections are a useful tool, even if imperfect. We do have an aging population. There's no doubt about it. And as you can see, this does not represent the whole population. But as you can see, the number of people aged 25 to 34, what we would call the young worker, has fallen by about 200,000 since 1990. The 65-plus population has been growing quite rapidly, and as you can see, we now have more people. So the dots start is where the most recent data we have. We now have more people aged 55 to 64 in our population in Connecticut than aged 25 to 34, which is actually a change. Some have made an argument that this is a sign of young people fleeing our state. Actually, and now this is the second hard math problem of the day. Each of us is 10 years older today than we were 10 years ago. And so, yes. And so if you just look at this, if you look at the population distribution we had in 2000, if you look at the population distribution we have in 2010, today's population is almost year for year exactly what it would have been if everybody who'd been in Connecticut 10 years ago just stayed. So there, obviously, we are a mobile society. People move in and out of our state all the time. But on net, we ended up with the same age distribution as we had before. Now, this just came out from the Census Bureau. Does show that we did see more out-migration in the 2 years from April 2010 to July 2012. So we had a natural increase of about 18,000, and then a negative net migration of only about 800. So we had a loss of people into other states and a gain in international immigration that netted about zero. Don't try to add those up, by the way. The Census Bureau says, well, there's a residual in the total. So we know the numbers aren't going to add. And this is giving this graphically. So this is a 10-year age distribution of the red line is the folks that left Connecticut for other states. So we see about 30,000 people between ages of 20 and 29 moved out of Connecticut moved from Connecticut to other states in 2011. This is just a one-year snapshot. The blue line is the number of people that moved to Connecticut from other states. And then we can add the green line, which is folks that moved to Connecticut from other nations. And if you add the blue and the green, again, we're back to basically where we were. So if you take the number of people who left Connecticut by age, it isn't just a question of the same number of people. It's actually the same number of 20-year-olds and the same number of 30-year-olds and the same number of 40-year-olds who left Connecticut. They were all replaced by someone of the same age. However, to get it to be zero net, you add in the folks that came here from other countries. So this is, when we're thinking about the workforce, we also have to think about all the discussion that is happening with regard to immigration reform. And then my final topic is just to talk about education. So as I started off, we talked about whose recovery is this nationally. We see the same thing in Connecticut. Those that have a bachelor's degree or more are really the ones that are succeeding our economy, and everyone else is having a difficult time. This is the unemployment rate for folks in Connecticut with a bachelor's degree or more is less than 4%. It's over 8% statewide, and folks who haven't even finished high school have an unemployment rate of 24%. And this is the 24%, right, is causing riots in some of the countries in Europe. An economy. And then this is my last slide of charts. So this is, I took my projections of occupations. I looked at the average income of folks in those occupations. And I looked at the education that's required to get into that occupation. And we see a lot of openings for folks that have less than a high school diploma, but they're not going to be making a whole lot of money. And we see a lot of openings for folks with a bachelor's degree or more, and they are making a significant amount of money. And in between, it sort of catch-as-catch-can. There are, obviously, as you can see, some very lucrative opportunities in the middle skill area. But it still becomes the best route, and I know there are exceptions, and I'm not trying to say college is for everybody, because I understand that certainly college is not for somebody who's going to start, not finish, and end up in a lot of debt. Right? So pushing everyone into college, if they're not going to succeed there, isn't a good idea. On the other hand, when we're talking about a strategic plan for higher education, recognize the importance of the work that you're doing. So I'll end with this little cartoon here. It's a little bit just to remind us that our goal is to train the folks who are going to build the robots, who are going to run the robots, who are going to be in charge of the robots. I know the commissioner has a lot to say about advanced manufacturing and how that has changed really to the point where some of the jobs that we used to have in Legion in Connecticut really have been replaced. But the jobs that are here now in a variety of industries are can be very lucrative. And Andy is here, and this is our contact information. Obviously, anytime, here now, tomorrow, next week, next month, we're always happy to hear from you, happy to answer any questions you have. And
quick questions for Mr. Flaherty.
And I ended right on time. What?
Any questions?
Could you talk a little bit about, and maybe you did this before I get here, so you do not need to repeat it, because I apologize for being late. But the actual, when you're doing these projections, how do you do that? What is the math behind your projections?
Sure. So we use, this really is, I think, federalism at its best. We use a methodology that is developed by the federal government, the Employment Training Administration of the U.S. Department of Labor. And so even though it isn't necessarily always the most state-of-the-art forecasting technique, it's done. We use the same method that's used in every other state so that our projections will be comparable. However, we're allowed to use our own judgment. So the final cut on what the projections are, a decision is made by myself and by Andy and by our commissioner within our department. The math, we have the data on the employment by industry. That data comes from the quarterly census of employment and wages. Every quarter, every employer files with us every person they have. So even though in some of our samples you might hear about the sampling error or this or that with the quarterly census of employment and wages, we have rock solid data as to who is working in or how many people are working in every industry, a detailed industry. We run a time series analysis of the data to produce the industry projections. So the industry, and we use, when I get real technical, we have VARs, auto regression analysis. We use OLS with independent variables based on the data that we have on income about the performance of things like the defense industry, where we think the federal budget is going. All of these factors go into our data with regard to the industry projections. We then, from our OES, which is the Occupational Employment Statistics, we get data from not from every employer, from a survey of employers every year of their staffing pattern. This is, we have a panel, and it's a four-year rotating panel, so that sometimes there is some lag in not having the most up-to-date data on what the staffing patterns are. But for every industry, we construct a staffing pattern. So if we have the hospital industry, we know, we have an estimate, we don't know. Based on the survey from the hospital industry, we have an estimate of how many are doctors, how many are nurses, how many are groundskeepers, how many are cafeteria workers, how many are janitors. And so for every industry, we have a staffing pattern that we put against the industry data, and then we do the projections based on the industry projections of what we think the occupational outlook is going to be, in this case, 10 years out.
Yes. Marianne?
What about job mobility? How does that fit into your projections? And I mean both people moving from one job to another or moving with the same skills from one place within the state to another.
Well, when employers report to us, they don't necessarily tell us anything about their employee in terms of doing what skills they have. So all of the data we have on that are survey-based. We have some data from the quarterly workforce indicators of sort of education and age by industry, but in that data we don't know the occupation. We can see the hires and we can see the separations in that data. Then the American Community Survey can give us some really rich demographic data about people in various occupations and what their incomes are. But that doesn't tell us anything about mobility because you don't see a person 2 years in a row. So we have different ways of sort of getting around, going around that question without actually having any ability to specifically answer it. Yes, Andy has it.
You might bring up the voluntary quit slot again because I think that's a struggle about what happened to job mobility after the recession. One indicator, if I may, of job mobility, if I understand your question, is people moving from position to position to improve themselves. And you can see by that green bar at the beginning of the recession, that really stopped. People kept their heads down, people could not move because their houses, they couldn't sell their houses, homes, they wanted to work. Things are improving slowly but surely, and the number of voluntary quits.
Well, we certainly have data on educational attainment by industry, by employment status, everything else. I mean, I have the chart showing the unemployment rate by education level. We certainly can get into more detail, and certainly if this commission is interested in that. I see. Yeah. That is a tougher thing to get, because any particular credential, there'd be small enough number of people in it that we aren't necessarily going to have to come up in our surveys. Yes, Judy.
I'm wondering, with all due respect, the employers that I talk to, when asked about 10 years out, are not always willing to stand by the fact that they even know what that is. Have you ever gone back and actually compared these projections to what happens? I mean, I guess I'm asking the question about, are these really, do they come to pass? Are these accurate?
That's an excellent question, and the answer is yes and no. Yes, we do compare, and no, they aren't accurate. And one of the things that, I should have answered the commissioner's question. One thing I forgot about with the commissioner's question. When we do the 10-year projections, we are doing a thought experiment based on a full employment economy. For two reasons, and there are two important reasons. One, we're not in the business of trying to project the business cycle. We don't know when there's going to be a financial collapse or anything like that. We're not that smart. Two, you need to have, it's the Education and Training Administration that is paying for the projections. We want a workforce trained for a full employment economy. So if one arrives, when one arrives, we have the workforce ready to do it. Now, unfortunately, that means that if you really did train for the full employment economy, when there is a recession, you're going to have some unused resources, some labor that is sitting on the sidelines. And that is happening today, and it is a real problem. And I know all of us are working to try to figure out how to change that. But we know we're going to miss the mark. I can't promise you in 2020 we're going to have a full employment economy in Connecticut. I wish that we would. What? Right. I wish that we could promise that. Yep. Okay. I'm happy to stay as long as you like.
I think I noted some optimism regarding manufacturing in your presentation. You have some solid evidence to support this optimism that somehow manufacturing is coming back to Connecticut?
Well, I mean, back is a... What I can say is the hemorrhaging has stopped. You know, our data shows that since the recession ended, we've had a slight increase in durable goods manufacturing employment in Connecticut, a slight decrease in non-durable goods manufacturing employment in Connecticut. So even in this recovery, we're seeing some continued structural change. But the massive month after month, thousands of job decline has ended. So that is the evidence is of the past couple of years that we seem, knock wood, that we've hit an inflection point, that the massive declines have stopped, and that our outlook for a stable, our projection is for a stable level of employment in manufacturing. And obviously, if there are some policy initiatives that improve it from there, we're sort of the baseline case in that situation. We aren't predicting that all of the policies that are being talked about are going to happen and that they're going to work. But if they do happen and they do work, then I'd be happy to be wrong and see my projections be too pessimistic.
Patrick, thanks very much.
Okay.
Commissioner Palmer, thank you so much for making this arrangement. Commissioner Smith.
Well, my slides are available, absolutely.
You have this,
this is my iPad. I was going to see your slides for you.
Oh, great.
Is that all right? Or?
Hi, everybody. Catherine Smith, Commissioner of Economic and Community Development, and my whole goal in life is going to prove that Patrick is wrong about all of these numbers that he's just shown you. What I wanted to do was walk you through at a very high level what sort of the foundation of the economic development strategy plan is for the state right now. And this has been pulled together by my team with a lot of input from people like DOL, though they may not know they've given us data for this. CERC, who has been doing some economic analysis for us. And it's also informed by a lot
lot of conversation with businesses here in the state about what was working, what wasn't working, and of course, you know, where we should be putting our next dollar of investment to try to make sure we can move forward in a very positive way. So you can go to the first slide. I'm going to talk about the strategy. We'll talk a little bit about how education fits into that strategy, because it also is a very important cornerstone. Yeah, we do financial assistance programs. We work with cities and towns to try to help clean up brownfields and all that kind of stuff. But without the education component, we won't be able to achieve what we want to achieve, and we'll see why in a few minutes. Then we'll just talk about our areas of focus, and then obviously Q&A if you're interested. By the way, I like to start almost every one of my presentations I do with our elevator speech, because I think sometimes when I wander around the state, I find that some of our own worst enemies live here in the state, and when we ask them what's great about Connecticut, they go, nothing. So we actually have a lot of really good things going for us, and so this is a list of them. I think the top one is the most important, and that's why education and the connection between education and economic development is so important. Because when you go to companies and ask them why they want to be in the state, they say it's because of the great talent. And I'll show you, we do have a few statistics in there, you know, Lindy, from various surveys that do get done, and we rank very well in terms of the ability for companies to reach and gain talent here in the state. It's a very, very important part. Innovation is also very important. And shifts in many parts of the economy, including manufacturing, the loss of over 100,000 jobs, but the manufacturing jobs that are here now are about the innovation, they're about the R&D piece, and the early stages of manufacturing that are so critical, or the one-off manufacturing that is so specialized and needed for very, very precise parts of manufacturing. So we are really good at innovation, and that is an area that I think, again, we might have underfunded in the last several years. So what we're trying to do with our strategy is to make sure that funding does come back into innovation. The third goal here is a bit aspirational, because I think some people would still say that state isn't always friendly to do business in, but we are making a lot of change in this arena as well, from leaning up state government, which we're actively involved with every week. Last week, for example, we had four teams from around state agencies, three state agencies go through a lean process and come up with fantastic ways to shorten up the process for our constituents. And we're trying to get out there, and if we can get back on stable footing from an economic perspective, just getting our budget balanced, I think you'll start to see a lot of the issues go away that are getting in the way of tax reform and things like that as well. We're investing some growth right now, and finally, and not certainly not least, because a lot of people put it at the top of their list, you know, we are actually a great location. You know, we're very near the big urban areas that people want to do their commerce in, but you get the advantages of living in a beautiful town or a city here in the state and getting a great education and all that kind of other things. So I just remind you, and feel free to copy this and talk about it with your friends and neighbors. One of the things that we did do when I came in was try to create this vision, mission, a real economic development plan with action steps and metrics, and really trying to hold people accountable for moving forward. Our vision, which we are still quite a ways away from, is to be in the top quartile of the states. And in fact, over the last 25 years or so, we've been in the bottom quartile. So that's a long way to move back up again. We had a great year in 2011, by the way. We were in top quartile then amongst all the states with a 2% growth rate. But we have still a long way to go to make that a sustainable and constant effort for ourselves. So the next part of our mission, that's really about the action plan. So we'll keep moving on. We'll come back to all the details of it. And instead talk for a minute about kind of the economy. Yet another one of these charts with jobs and those surveys. This is the employment by cluster. And I should have come to you to get updated, right? I got this from actually from the bottom, Michael Porter, because we did engage him a little bit of discussion around our clusters and which ones had real opportunity and which ones were less important to us going forward. But you can see our strategy here in terms of focusing on certain clusters to really put more time and attention into. And by the way, if a cluster isn't circled up there, it doesn't mean we're going to ignore it. It just means we don't see it as the best opportunity for growth going forward. So we picked a mix of the biggest that have opportunities to grow because of the strengths that we have here in the state, and then the emerging areas, places where we may not be too terribly big today, but we have have a cadre of talent, or we have companies that are really interested in this, or we have great tax incentives, or whatever it is, that are going to help us grow. So these are the areas that we're primarily focused on in United Economic Development. So when we're looking at first five type companies, we're trying to make sure that they fit into one of these categories, because that's where we think our best opportunities are going forward. So as you can see, we've got insurance and financial services, healthcare and life sciences. Healthcare is probably the biggest of the industries we have here. The life science, bioscience is a bit of the emerging side of that, but very, very important. Advanced manufacturing, which is, I get reprimanded sometimes for using that word, but I think that is, while we still have many manufacturers that are not, quote unquote, advanced, I think that's where the future is going to lie. That's where the growth will largely come from. Tourism, which people forget about, but it is a huge part of the economy, $11 billion. And then the emerging digital, green, and IT are really the emerging areas. And I think if you look at that group, there's one thing you can look at that's in common of the requirements for the people that work in those groups. Well, education, but what kind of education? Advanced degrees to some degree, but really important at all levels, STEM. Science, technology, engineering, and math. And I think that is, so while we can't pick exactly how many jobs in each of these clusters maybe in the next 10 years, I think we do have a pretty good idea that there are going to be really strong requirements for STEM-type education in virtually every single one of these clusters. And yes, there will be a need for, you know, of the middle skill jobs and from the high end, but I think this is really very, very important for us to recognize as we think about where we want to invest our education dollars as well. So that's one of the reasons you saw the governor propose for UConn this large investment in STEM.
Can I interrupt for a second? Under emerging opportunities, I don't see nanotechnology, nanoscience, and nanotechnology anywhere, and yet I know the future is great for that particular sector.
Yeah, and I don't think we disagree with you. I think, especially in healthcare, we're seeing nano a lot, and I think some of our advanced manufacturing.
Also, photovoltaics and batteries.
Yeah, and well, there's a whole bunch of things that have great opportunity. I didn't use them all, but under the those are the larger companies that we have brought to Connecticut to grow, and that was a new insurance company for Connecticut. It's called Navigators, and I think there are many insurance companies that are still talking now about growing their presence here in the state, and so I feel it's got a great opportunity. Plus, on the financial services side, we sometimes forget about Southwestern companies, but that Southwestern company doesn't necessarily remind us about it. There are a ton of financial services in the broad sense of investment management, private equity, so we still have this is a huge part of our economy and a big part of the state domestic product, if you will. So next slide, healthcare bioscience again. The bioscience is about 800 companies, but of course this sector has enormous opportunity just in the basic delivery of healthcare over the next 20 years because of our aging population, because of the emphasis on healthcare. But importantly here, now we get into some of the areas where our talent is really again, we've seen the governor make a very large statement about his support for this sector and, of course, the legislature as well, with not just the bioscience initiative at UConn, but, of course, with the arrival of Jackson Labs. And I can tell you that just we have a lot of interest from bioscience companies inside and outside the state for doing more growth here. So we're very excited about this. I mentioned advanced manufacturing and aerospace. Again, we are blessed to have extremely strong anchor tenants in the form of all the United States technologies companies like Command, aerospace components manufacturing team, which is, you know, about position because of the leadership position we have in additive manufacturing, in materials, and in digital in general. So stay tuned on that. So again, this is not an area that I'd say, you know, you have some big exodus in jobs in manufacturing, but with the right emphasis in the right focused areas, we think this is something from there and we can take it all time. Innovation, I mentioned, was something very, very important that we wanted to re-stimulate here in Connecticut. You know, we do really well, actually, in terms of patents, literally number up in the top 10 states for developing patents. But we're not so good at taking those patents and turning them into commercial operations. Part of that, I think, is because a lot of the patents are developed by some of those large companies that we just mentioned, and they don't have the resources to go ahead and work on every single one of the good ideas that they've generated by their scientists. But we want to find ways to get the great ideas that are coming out of our universities, that are coming out of entrepreneurs, and make it much easier for those people to develop those ideas and develop them here in the state. So the innovation ecosystem has been developed at CI, Connecticut Innovations. Connecticut Innovations, through the job school, is giving more capital to invest into these pre-seed and seed companies as well. And I'm really excited to say that the ecosystem alone has generated, I think it's about 350 new companies have come to the ecosystem in the last 4 months since we really got the doors open to try to get help. Maybe that's technical advice and counsel, but maybe it's also access to capital. So a big area of emphasis, and we think something that could be responsible for generating a lot of new ideas and new jobs. You know, one of the things that happens is not every one of these companies make it, because a lot of them, maybe the idea wasn't quite ready for prime time. But the ones that do, if you look at Pyre One, or if you look at Alexion, companies that came out of, those two in particular came out of Yale, and boy, now, you know, one of them is listed on the Fortune, well, they're both listed companies with hundreds of employees in the state. So we want to find those and help them get started, knowing full well that not every single one of the companies we do business with will make it as they do. Next slide. Digital media, again, we've seen a lot of activity in this space. You know, ESPN built their fourth very large studio here in the state, actually still under construction. NBC relocated all of their sports operations from Canada, Philadelphia, New York, to Stamford, Connecticut. It's become a hotbed of this activity for Connecticut, and I think these are, again, great, great jobs. They're high-paying jobs, average of $100,000 per job, even a startup, even for early people being hired from those initial job offerings. So there's a lot of opportunity in this space as well, and it's movies, it's television, it's games, it's all kinds of great opportunities coming our way. So we think this is going to have a lot of opportunity for in the next few years. I think we have green down here as well. If you're not aware of all the work that's been done at SEFIA, which is the Clean Energy Finance and Investment Authority, it's really worth looking into. The last 2 years, we've turned that from being essentially a subsidy provider for solar panels into being a green bank in the greatest sense of the word, with a lot of great opportunities for not just improving the energy efficiency of all of our homes and houses, but also creating new opportunities for new jobs in the state and leveraging private sector dollars into things like fuel cells, bio generation, and things like that. So it's a great opportunity. And the CPACE, which legislature passed last year, has now been adopted by 27 communities. CPACE is a great, great opportunity for companies to invest in green technologies and use this, with the private financing, essentially use their tax payments to repay that private sector entity over the course of 10 to 20 years, depending on the deal. So it's good for the job. And we also have, nobody knows this, but we are one of the major states for fuel cells, right? We have 30% of the national jobs here in the state for fuel cells. If you look at just the region, it's like 55% of the jobs for New York and the New region. So we're growing in some very interesting green areas, and I think, you know, to your point now, they've got new job titles, actually, yep, things like that, which I think will help them to develop. So the rest of the strategy, besides growing and retaining our existing base of jobs in those targeted clusters and fostering innovation and making sure we grow our talent pool, is to look at the rest of the economy as well. So building vibrant neighborhoods, community, making sure we have housing that's affordable to our workforce is extremely important, and really making sure that overall the arts, the culture, that these are not just great jobs, but we have really wonderful places, continue to have wonderful places for people to live. So all this is part of the strategy. The last bullet there is really to make sure that internally we work and recognize that this takes a village, right? So this is not just DECD or just DECD and Department of Housing. This is really a strategy that we all need to own, all the parties involved in the state, the state government, the local governments, and all of our not-for-profit and home development sector partners. Let me spend just a minute on the talent piece and a little bit more of a deep dive, because I think that's really what the mission of this organization and this cluster of people is. So we mentioned that there are a few things we can measure about our talent, not necessarily at the middle skills level, but often at the highest skills. So we rank 3 to 16% of our population having advanced degrees and 6 in science, as I mentioned before. We're also very
think we've got time for one or two questions. Any questions of the commissioner? Anyone? Well, hearing none, let me say we're well served by the efforts of both agencies and the leadership of both commissioners, and we thank you for the good work that you have been doing under this administration. We will move on and have a discussion in regards to the RFP. And before we go to that, we will have presentations to inform this group for the next two meetings. Judy Greiman, are you still good for next month? Okay. And you're going to be discussing strategies from other states. Is that correct? Okay, perfect. And then we'll line up a speaker or two for the meeting following that. I would, in advance, like to thank our staff, John Harnick and Braden Hosh, for their good work on pulling this RFP together. We're well served in that regard. And if you could go to the document that has on the top line revised timeline, you'll see some print in red towards the bottom of that. And this is our expectation at this point that there would be a public proposal on June 21 and that we would be entering into a contract with a consultant by September of this year. The plan is that the consultancy would last for a period of 12 months and not beyond that. So our expectation is that the consultant would come back before this group in September 2014. That's the plan. We're going to stick with it. Any questions about the timeline? Okay, hearing none. You'll see a... let me just go over the other documents that you have in front of you. One is a draft of the Connecticut Master Plan for Higher Education for the RFP. It's a three-page document. You'll see a procurement information checklist. You will see a scoring sheet for the respondents to the RFP. And committee member Vagos spent some valuable time preparing a draft of what he would consider to be a matrix for a proposed strategic plan for higher education and workforce development, and that's a four-page document. I appreciate the time that he spent on this, and it should give us some sense of what we might expect from the successful bidder for this consultancy. So we're going to let that consultant demonstrate their skills and expertise in coming back with something that probably looks similar to this document, but I think this should be helpful to all of us around the table here in getting a better sense of what our expectations are, at least in part, for this consultant. Let me go back to the scoring, the proposed scoring for the bids from the consultants, and you'll see that you'll see the weights given each of the each of these line items here: 20% going to expertise, 20% organizational capacity, and you can see the rest. I won't try to read through all of this. Any discussion about that? Any feedback? Any recommendations? Comments? And that would be the time, because hearing none, we will use this as the as part of the evaluation process. Well, hearing none, I'm going to assume that everyone is satisfied with this. If you're not, please try to reach me over the next week or before the conclusion of this meeting, certainly. If we're good with that, I'd like to have you turn to the draft of the
RFP document. And Braden, I don't know if you would care to discuss this at any length.
Thanks, John. I'll just give a brief overview. Representative Willis and Chairman Shimo asked me to help draft some of these. I do them occasionally in my other work. So just based on the statutory requirements, and you'll see a good deal of the text from the law actually put into the RFP because those are the building blocks of what we want them to deliver. We wrote up just a brief preface, including what those things were. We did mention some of the plans that we had circulated around, and we had also included some of the dates that we had expected to be revised to 2020 and 2025. But by and large, the only significant addition that I think we really put in here that's not in the law is the inclusion of stakeholders piece, recognizing that these plans tend to live or die by virtue of the process and buy-in that the larger community, both of inside education and outside education, has in terms of their input and participation. So those are the things that we included, fully expecting that the deliverables that come back are a product that people have had some say in. So I guess that would be my overview.
Thank you. No, I think we have a pretty good product here, actually. I'm very, very happy with that. I think there's a number of the other items that I've been emailing. We are making, Representative Willis is taking the lead on making the statutory changes that will align us with this document. Right now, those different dates that are the due dates, but that seemed like an easy fix. I think we still need to discuss, and we could do this in a smaller group, actually, once we're happy with the overall specifications of, you know, how do we want to do the payment methodology, tie it to the milestones, and kind of get a little bit more specific for the contractor, or the proposers, I should say, regarding the content that we're going to be looking for with each milestone and each presentation. But those are things I think we could handle in a smaller group. John, that would be my suggestion, recommendation to you. And then really the evaluation criteria, I think we have it here, but I think we just need to go over and make sure this is exactly everything that we're looking for. I think the contractor capacity and experience was, I think Braden did a good job in putting it in this document, so I thought that we could work with that. So I think there's a lot here we could work with, a few things we could do offline, and we can get this out. So I'd like to meet within the next 2 weeks.
All right. Commissioner Smith?
You know, and thank you. I apologize I didn't read quite as quickly as you were asking for some comments and questions on this, but I have two overarching thoughts related to these documents. And again, I haven't read them in great detail. But one would be this notion that we're using a status quo projection. And I guess I think that is something you should really test with some of the key stakeholders and make sure that we think it really does reflect the reality we're going to face. Because I think that is so important, right? If we have a projection that isn't really clearly where we're headed as a state, that could make all the rest of the analysis quite challenging. So that's just one comment. And then the second is, you know, I feel very strong that we need to tie this into the expected growth in our economy and make sure that our educational institutions understand where that's going. So, you know, one of the things that I would love to see from this, I'm not certain it's in here thoroughly or as well as I'd like to see it yet, is really that kind of, you know, you heard me off the cuff say STEM is going to be one of the most important types of education we want to make sure we focus on. But I would love to have this report also come out with those kinds of, maybe not, it's going to be, you know, 15% in manufacturing and 25% in insurance, but more, here are the critical skills that need to be developed. Here's how we think we can build them in at every level of our academic go forward policies, et cetera. So just those two suggestions to the group that's putting the RFP together.
Great, very good points. Teresa.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted a follow-up comment from the commissioner, and I think in the RFP it doesn't talk about that middle skill level, which in her report she addressed as important for us to focus on. It talks about post-secondary and talks about bridging the achievement gap, but the middle skill level, which might not involve post-secondary education but some kind of advanced training, I think needs to be included in the RFP.
Great. Thank you. John.
Yes, I know I've shared some things with you, John, but it seems to me that very important to the inclusion of the stakeholders and to get this report seen as a document to work from as opposed to another that gets put in the file cabinet or somewhere else. I think there needs to be some serious thought about the branding that we're looking for in terms of the report. And I don't mean that in terms of going out and selling a product, but rather how we bring our information together into the report and what it does is it sets a vision of what we think needs to be done with regard to higher education and employment advancement in order to have the workforce that we need, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know if that makes any sense to anybody, but it does to me.
I think that's a fair point, and having a little sizzle to such a document that probably would be helpful with in terms of the stakeholders that will ultimately review and be part of the implementation of the strategy. Brayden, did you have a reaction to that?
Actually, it was back on the middle skill point. We actually did include that in the draft. It's bullet 3 under projections, where it breaks out post-secondary enrollment by in-state, out-of-state, and by level. That less than 2-year level is the credentialing certificate level that you would expect to see, and that's, again, there by completion. So we are expecting to see that included.
Teresa, does that serve your purposes or not?
It was, but not it's not included in the numerical goals. So if we're suggesting that in our economy there will be an increase in that level of technology, I think it's not necessarily important to just make a projection about what that would be, but how do we educate for that?
I think the change then is to add those parentheses again for the by level, just to make that clear, because I would expect to again see it in the numerical projections based on what's above, but just to make it extra clear, let's add those parentheses.
Is that good? Thank you. Chris?
John, at the risk of speaking at my first meeting, there are two things that come to mind for me. One is the building on the demographic data provided early on. And it might be necessary, I think, to call out explicitly the needs of the older worker, because if we look over this time frame, workers over the age of 50 will continue to – the current workers over the age of 50 can anticipate working 15 to 17 more years, and that their higher education needs – it's an audience, it's a market to be served, and that the emphasis, at least in the language as I read this rather quickly – isn't accounting for the needs of that age group, which can, in fact, be a very significant part of the talent solution over the period that this strategy addresses. So some way of calling out the opportunity and needs of institutions serving the older student. And then secondly, it is alluded to, but perhaps we could have a bit more on the in the section that is about recommendation for policy, the last bullet point, about the needs of minority and non-traditional students and addressing the affordability of tuition and the issue of student debt. The majority of spending by individuals, the majority of financing of in the privates and to a very great degree as well in the publics does come from the individual student and the student's family. And some calling out the issue of financing education, not merely the management of debt or the affordability of tuition. Those are two of the three elements. Where does the money come from that enables you to pay the tuition, and how much debt exists versus how much and how is that debt handled. So some itemization or listing there the idea of financing mechanisms for education, personal to the individual.
Anyone else? Okay. Braden, John, any other final comments from your end? Okay. Commissioners, you good? Yes. Committee members? Great. Well, then we're gonna move this forward. It's good input. And then at this point, barring anything unforeseen, we will look for that public proposal come June 21. Is that correct? Thereabouts?
Yes. Well, you know, as I pointed out in the timeline, the things that need to happen, and I think we should meet prior to the end of the month. So we can do that. We could probably get all that and yes, publish.
Okay. So we are on track at this point to meet these timelines, right?
I believe so. I think the comments we've had, we should incorporate. And like I recommended, having a meeting within the next week or so, and we could finalize everything, I believe.
Okay, great. I think we're any other comments in regards to the RFP process? Anything at all? Okay. Any other business to come before the committee? Hearing none, we stand adjourned. We'll see you next month.